won't you welcome Ellis Rifkin?
I'm certainly grateful for you to that you selected that particular appreciation so that all of you are now alerted to how profound I am, and consequently, you will...
Can you move into the mic a little bit?
Consequently, can you hear me now? Consequently, you will lend me your ears. First of all, it's a great honor to be here. It's a great pleasure to have had this opportunity at long last to meet Rabbi Joseph and to spend a very, very intriguing dinner time with him. And, of course, most of all, it's a great opportunity to try to share with you some of my own thinking with respect to the problem that you are dealing with in this series of lectures, which have to do with the Jewish survival and how that survival is to be accounted for. Now, there is simply a matter of fact that the Jewish people, and only the Jewish people, have had an experience, an historical experience, that had its beginnings in the ancient Near East, maybe 3,000 or so years ago, as a small semi-nomadic grouping, and that has traversed over all of the stages and phases of the evolution and development of Western civilization to that point at time that we find ourselves now in, where this people is on the very frontiers, more precociously than any other grouping or any other people of the first post-industrial society in world history, and the first society whose major foundations are built on knowledge acquisition, knowledge processing, and knowledge dissemination. Now, that in and of itself is an incredible experience, because there simply is no comparable experience. All other groupings, all other peoples, as Toynbee pointed out many, many years ago, have sooner or later, no matter how grand their civilization may have been, sooner or later came into confrontation with a challenge to which they could not adequately or creatively respond. The Jews are the only people who have met every single challenge along the way. And not only have they met every single challenge along the way, but they met each challenge, not by simple survival, but they've met each challenge in a creative kind of way. And each challenge in turn enriched the power of this people to play a creative role in the history, a special creative role in the history of all of humankind. As if this wasn't enough, it is important to bear in mind that this people was, from its very beginnings, semi-nomadic beginnings, a tiny people. That through all of its first experiences, once they settled in the land, was one in which they enjoyed political sovereignty only for a few brief years. And they enjoyed this political sovereignty not because of any exercise of might or exercise of power, but by virtue of the loss of the exercise of that might and power on the part of the great empires, the great imperial powers of antiquity in the ancient Near East, such as Egypt and Assyria. It was only in the troughs between one imperial regnum that there was the possibility at all of playing at sovereignty. disporting at sovereignty, having the illusion that simply because the situation was such that no imperial power at that moment could exercise its might, that therefore a Saul or a David or a Solomon were really real potentates. It's true that when they did have this opportunity, they could play at being potentates. They could even play at struggling to gain advantage over other little powers and even to find themselves at odds and constant conflict with each other when the United Monarchy came to an end and there was a splitting of the kingdom between North and South. So that the experience with political independence was very brief, and in the biblical period was a very a poor showing. It didn't do so well. After all, in a little land such as the land of Israel happens to be able to split into two kingdoms is, I would say, quite an historic achievement. And as you read through the prophets and the historical books of the Bible, it is very, very evident that it was this period of sovereignty which was the most difficult and which most endangered the continuation of this people in terms of its special vocation, its special way of looking at itself as the selected people of God. And then the second spate of independence occurred during the Hasmonean, the brief period of Hasmonean rule, when by virtue, not of any intrinsic power, but by virtue of the breaking up of the Hellenistic monarchies on the one hand, and Rome's unreadiness yet to actually rule directly, it was possible to enjoy a very brief period of independence under the Hasmoneans, but very much like the split kingdom. Within a generation or so, there was a bitter civil war that split the people against the Hasmonean rulers who had gone over to the Sadducees, where the people at large were so loyal to the teachers of the halacha that they would have nothing of this of Alexander Aeneas, of the Hasmonean king at the time, and there was an eruption of a bitter civil war that could only be finally dealt with when the wife of Alexander Aeneas, Salome Alexandra, restored the halacha and the authority of the Pharisees and the authority of the sages. And then, very shortly thereafter, Rome began to move definitively and assertively, first through pawns like Herod, and then directly through procurators. And when the Jews, in desperation, rose up against the harshness of Roman rule and tried to gain independence, as you well know, the second temple was destroyed. The raised to the ground. Many of the people were sent into exile, enslaved, and the Jerusalem for a very, very long time could not serve the role that it had previously played. Now, from that point on until the birth of the State of Israel, Jews lived primarily a diaspora experience. They never enjoyed independence again until the rise of the State of Israel, and even the rise of the State of Israel occurred at the time when a major imperial power, Great Britain, was disintegrating, and before the Pax Americana, America's effort to restructure the world enabled once again Jews to take advantage of the situation and to have a, hopefully in this instance, a longer experience of some kind of political sovereignty, but I need not tell you how very fragile the situation is now as to what the outcome may ultimately be. So with these very few exceptions, two of which were abysmal failures, the period of the monarchy and the Hasmonean monarchy with the civil war that lasted almost through the entire reign of Alexander Eunaeus. There is a history of powerlessness by any kind of normative measure. If we take political sovereignty as a norm and political power as the way to security, the Jews have been the most powerless of people and the most insecure from this point of view of all the peoples of the world. And yet this powerless people is the only people that made it. The most insecure of nations somehow or other had had the knack for that which makes for ultimate security. That is the ultimate security of the continuity. Not only of a people continuing through time, after all the Samaritans continue through time, but who continue to move through time in a continuously creative way, shaping and reshaping itself in the course of this remarkable kind of experience. Now, when we add to this, and we begin to look at what the sources of this security of the insecure might possibly be, we also had to take note of the fact that it was this people that generated out of its weakness at the very time where it seemed it was nip and tuck as to whether they would survive at all, at the time when the Assyrians came in and destroyed the kingdom of Israel, threatened the kingdom of Judah, that it was precisely at that point of time when from any kind of measure of what is essential, the essential criteria for survival, they were able to deal with defeat, with devastating defeat, and find within this devastating defeat the source for that kind of incredible survival, which they were subsequently able to map out for themselves and forge for themselves. And that was in the prophecies of the likes of Isaiah, and particularly Isaiah, where in the face of the facts, the face of empirical logic, the God of this people, the God of Israel, had been a dismal failure. The test of a God is to provide security. The test of the God is to give you a land. The test of a God is to sustain you in the land. And the ultimate test of a God is to be able to enable you to withstand an imperial conquest by virtue of that omnipotence that this God was presumed to have. And here this God was being defeated by the facts in the most obvious and the clear-cut kind of way. There was only one logic, and this God ought to give up any kind of claims to being a God at all, much less the only God that there is. At that particular moment in time, Isaiah viewed the process as evidence not of God's powerlessness, but of his incredible omnipotence. Because what is more powerful? How does a God most powerfully show himself? It is by taking other nations, by taking Assyria, turning it into the rod of God's anger to beat down his people because they hadn't fulfilled the covenant. Now, in the face of that interpretation, or as one might say, misinterpretation, in the face of refusing to let the facts speak clearly, to let empirical logic triumph, they simply use the facts themselves as evidence of the contrary. Here is the most powerful God, and now we know it, because he is the rod of God's anger. And fortunately, the quickness with which Assyria was overthrown by Babylonia, and the quickness with which Babylonia was subsequently to be overthrown by Persia, seemed to provide that factual evidence, that factual proof of Isaiah's claim, because Assyria was unable to sustain itself when facing Babylonia. And Babylonia was unable to sustain itself with all its power when faced by Persia. So that by the time the Persians allowed the Jews to return to the land, it was seemed as though the facts were now speaking out in confirmation of Isaiah's portrayal, his mode of interpretation, rather flying in the face of the facts. It now seems that this is what the facts was necessarily add up to. That is, this little people was witness to the dialectical processional of history, to a dialectical processional which has still not come to an end, in which imperial power moves on the scene, seems to be unconquerable, and is then collapses and is displaced by another imperial power. As Persia was displaced by Alexander, as Alexander was displaced by the Hellenistic monarchies and the splitting up of his empire, the Roman Empire subsequently displacing the Hellenistic monarchies in terms, the rise of Islam and the fall of Islam, the rise of Christendom and the fall of Christendom, the rise of nation states and the fall of nation states, all seem to be, as we now look back, all seem to have been previsioned. In this interpretation given by Isaiah, these prophecies of Isaiah, which were simply based on faith that the God of this little people is the one God and an omnipotent God, and all other peoples, however imperialistically powerful they might be, can only have a limited stay, a limited time in the arena of history, so that we find this in terms of this uniqueness of this people, the fact that back then, at the moment of greatest impotence, there was an interpretation of the facts put together in such a way that it spelled out omnipotence, and then a whole array of historical facts through the rest of Jewish history seemed to confirm what Isaiah had intuitively sensed about not only the ultimate nature of this God as being omnipotent, but the ultimate nature of the historical processional of empire following empire. So not only then do we find this remarkable turning the facts on their refusing to bend to an empirical logic in the situation. Not only did this turn out to be a key mode for survival, because nothing factual could ever be what it seemed to be for the Jewish people. If they were prosperous subsequent to this, then this was evidence of God's bounty. If they suffered, it was evidence of their sins. There was no evidence that could, in the factual realm, no experience in the experiential realm that could refute this kind of view of God. Whatever occurred, good or ill, was equally evident of the omnipotence of this God. And therefore, because they clung to the contrafactual, they clung to some kind of notion that the all-powerful was that God which they made gave them their peoplehood, that it turns out that this belief sustained them. And by virtue of the fact that this belief did not exist among other people, seemed to be the reason that they did not survive. So that we have to come up with a whole new concept of security, insofar as the security of nationhood, of peoplehood is concerned. The normative is not the normal notion of power being the source of security, but the notion that being a people of God is an ultimate security, that the most insecure of nations, the people, turned out to be, in a sense, the most secure, and the most secure of empires all turned out to have insecurity embedded in their very nature of their existence. Now, then we add to this incredible kind of concept that they elicited from historical experience. And then we add to that the fact that not only were they able to secure their own continuity, but they had gave birth to two world-girdling religions. This little nothing of a power gave birth to Christianity, which became world-girdling religion. And it was the belief system, the belief in this single God and this single God's omnipotence, however much facts seemed to be proved the contrary, was also that which generated out of itself Islam, which, like Christianity, was able to spread widely throughout the world. And insofar as what is preservative of Christianity and of Islam, the political power has always played a much more significant role than it has in the history of the Jewish people. What really preserves both Christianity and Islam at its very core is this ultimate belief that is the grounding of Israel, the continuation of Israel throughout the ages. Now, if we then add to this the fact that the diaspora experience of the Jews was no simple diaspora experience. It wasn't as though the Jews simply had to deal with the diaspora in Sasanian Persia, or deal with a diaspora in Islam, or deal with a diaspora in the Christian world, or to deal with a diasporas in the modern nation states. They lived in multiple diasporas at the same time, which were radically different from one another, that the structures of the Jewish people erected for themselves and built for themselves, and the thrust of their peoplehood and their creativity was radically different one from the other, because there was this remarkable capacity not only to live in diasporas regionally, territorially separated from each other, and in diasporas, each of which represented a ruling civilization that was radically different, as the Muslim was from the Christian, but they had that keen capacity for absorption, of drawing in what was critical and vital and essential in each one of these separate and distinct diasporas and civilizations. One simply has to put side by side the Babylonian Talmud alongside the Palestinian Talmud, and you know immediately that the two Talmuds are different, not simply because there are different scholars that are seeing things in different ways, It's a different form. So different that the only explanation can be, well, one was an experience in the Sasanian world, the other's an experience in a collapsing, breaking down Roman world. Or when one considers the way in which the essentials, the essential creativity of Islamic society was translated in the Golden Age of Spain into the most remarkable kind of poetry that we still remember and still read in the liturgy and can still enjoy by virtue of its profundity and its sensitivity. Poetry, which had simply faded out after the biblical period. There's no poetry that you will find after the Psalms down to the Golden Age of Spain in the 10th, 11th, and 12th, and the 12th century. Poetry has simply faded out. And now it burst out with all of its intense individuality, religiosity, with its uniqueness that could only come by virtue of a Jewish peoplehood, bursting out with a creativity that can only be accounted for by the bursting out of the muse, the poetic muse within Islam itself, in Spain itself. And remember, when Yehuda Levi wrote his Ode to Zion, he did not write a song. It's not modeled on any of the Psalms. It's modeled on the most advanced meter and rhyme and form and structure of the greatest Muslim poets of the time, so that you have the situation that the most compelling and the most deep feeling expression for Zion and the need to find one's way back to Zion has its power. Not by virtue of a Psalms as the model, but by virtue of Islamic poetry as the model. Take and remove Islamic poetry, you don't have Yehuda Levi's masterpiece. You don't have Ibn Gabirul, one of the most incredible liturgical pieces, which are the creation of Ibn Gabirul, read on the high holidays and so on. Where would that be? Didn't come from anything that was previously indigenous. So that when one follows on, turn to Rashi. And compare Rashi with Maimonides. You put Maimonides' Guide, not just the Guide of the Perplexed, put his Mishnah Torah alongside Rashi's commentary. And he said, this is the fruits of Islam. This is the fruits of Christian feudal Europe. That's how radically different they are from one from the other. The Guide of the Perplexed, you don't have any kind of philosophy in Northern Europe at the time. And we also know the kind of struggles that occurred between Maimonists and anti-Maimonists in terms of which was, in other words, in a sense, it was a struggle between that form of Judaism, that way of looking at the world through this Jewish peoplehood, coming from living in a sophisticated society where philosophy, Aristotle and so on, had developed to the full, and the creation, the Jewish creation of Christian Europe, which was as clashing between Jews and Jews as it was between Christians and Muslims. So that if we move through all of Jewish history, we find indelibly imprinted, indelibly impressed on all of the most authoritative and inspirational creativity. We find that we have that imprimatur. We have the imprimatur of the ancient Near East in the Bible. Pick up the Bible, there's no way that you can escape the ancient Near East, not only because you're dealing with problems of the ancient Near East, but you're dealing with the form, with the literature, with everything but the belief in a single God, being at one with an ancient Near Eastern experience. You go through the Mishnah. If you look at the Mishnah and you compare it with the five books of Moses and you compare it with the prophets and so on, you see that you're reading a Roman law book. Law in the five books of Moses, law in the Torah, is never spelled out in this way. When we read the five books of Moses, we're reading a law within the matrix in the context of history. Historical narrative. There's no narrative in the Mishnah. There's no narrative in the Talmud, any of the Talmud. There's no narrative in the Gonic literature. It's all law, or agadic is separate, but the agadic is not the giving a history, or long stories like the story of Elijah and so on. They're little snippets, little like anecdotes, entirely different. Where is that from? It certainly isn't the Bible, isn't the model. But take a look at Greco-Roman law books, and you'll see, my goodness, it can only be because of an experience with the Greco-Roman world. And I've already mentioned to you the impress of Islam. But this is also true with respect to this subsequent period with the modernization and westernization, and the way in which Jews had to struggle with these problems, like a Moses Mendelssohn, or in the case of ultra-Orthodoxy, of Samson Rachel Hirsch, and so on. All of this we find in our most inspirational text, our most authoritative text, our most impactful text. So that in order to undergo this Jewish experience, simply by moving through its creativity, you are simultaneously moving always through two worlds. The continuity of what the Jew is bringing to this new experience with another civilization, and that which that civilization is compelling the Jews to draw in as part of their new Jewish identity, if survival is to be possible. Now that is true of no other people. Read all of the major sources of the American experiences. It doesn't give you an experience with Christian medieval Europe. It doesn't give you an experience with Islam. You don't have in your fundamental law books of the land Aristotle. Principles of Aristotle creeping out and showing through by virtue of actually wrestling with Aristotle. And the same way that throughout the ancient Near East, I mean, there's no compulsion to read any book of the Bible, to go back to the ancient Near East per se, to account for the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution. And this is true for all the rest of the countries of Europe as well. Now that is utterly unique, which in other words, it means that if we're going to try to understand how survival was possible, it was possible by continuous process of absorption, not imitation. There's nothing imitative about the Mishnah. The Mishnah, as you well know, is as Jewish can be. The genius was to absorb and to imprint, or to absorb within that matrix of ongoing continuous Jewish identity that therefore gave it the hallmark of being Jewish. And it's very, very difficult to discover that the Mishnah really is incomprehensible unless you know something about Roman jurisprudence. It certainly wasn't the way it was looked at in the Middle Ages or Eastern European yeshivas or yeshivas today in New York or and Israel and so forth. So this then is the another incredible uniqueness that we factually have to take into account. And then there was this still a further uniqueness in terms of the diaspora experience. In dealing with the insecurity of the Jewish people, the fact that we've undergone so many pogroms and we've undergone so many sufferings and so many ways have seemingly suffered because of our abnormalities of being this people, misplaced people, a disfigured people. We fail to take into account that the diaspora experience was an experience with the security and the insecurity of the peoples among whom we lived. There wasn't a single society that Jews lived in that did not extend to the Jews not only the right of settlement, not only the right of living in a land that was not where they had no power to live. It was simply on the sufferance of those who allowed them to settle there. But frequently they were privileged. When Jews first came to Alexandria, they had no power, no right to come to Alexandria. Back in ancient Alexandria, they were Greeks. How was it then that it was not only a Hellenistic king, a Ptolemy, but a king who believed that he was God, or at least wanted everybody to confirm or that they should believe at least that he was God, making a special exemption for these Jews who had no armies, who had no way of forcing anything on these on a Ptolemy emperor, and showered them with a privilege that was only given to the Greeks, that they could have their own autonomous community with all of the rights of the Greeks, and they were separated out from the Egyptians who had no such rights at all, with the additional right of not believing in the emperor as God, and because of this having their own separate polis, their own separate politarmia, their own separate autonomy alongside this other autonomy on the basis of co-equality. Well, after all, where was the power for this coming from? This was something that was bestowed upon them, a powerless people. And all that was required of them was to acknowledge not the divinity of the emperor, but the sovereignty of the emperor. And that they did by building prayer houses where they offered up prayers to God, the one God, for the preservation of the health, well-being, prosperity of the emperor. Now, it is true that a time came in the first century where this Jewish community collapsed, where it was subject to pogroms, where the Jews who lived in the finest areas of Alexandria were herded off and forced to live in the equivalent of a kind of a ghetto. But this was when the larger society, the Alexandrian society of which they were part, was also collapsing. It was when the Ptolemies were secure, Jews enjoyed security. When they became insecure, the Jews were the first to feel the first pangs of the insecurity that ultimately was to denude Alexandria of that incredible greatness that it had. I mean, Alexandria in antiquity was just a marvel, and it was gone, never really to recuperate ever again. The Jews were part of that process. It wasn't as though Alexandria got scot-free and the Jews were the only ones that had to suffer. So they participate. The Jews have participated in the security of nations when they're on the make. They are the first to experience the insecurity of nations when these nations are feeling the first signs of disintegration and collapse. Because the same thing happened again and again. I won't deal with all of the instances. The Sasanian world, in the beginning, Jews were privileged, even though they were not Sasanian. Sasanian society begins to collapse. Jews suffer. In Islam, Islam is one of the best examples. Eastern Islam, the Jews were so privileged in Eastern Islam that they could have a goanate, they could do engage in trade, commerce, and so on, had very, very great prosperity, and it was a very, very flourishing epoch until the 10th century. But in the very 10th century, when the Abbasid Empire was collapsing, and the Jews were feeling the consequences of this collapse, Jews living in Western Islam, in Islamic Spain, were on the ascendancy. Here in an Islamic land, under the same aegis, Islamic aegis, a Jew could become the equivalent of a secretary of state in the minister of foreign affairs, like Khazda ibn Shukrut. could become a vizier, the power behind the throne, as in the case of Samuel Hanagi, even though this was absolutely forbidden by the Quran. So here you have Jews living in insecure Islam, suffering. Jews living in secure Islam in Spain, enjoying all the fruits of the security of the host people, only in Spain again. In the 13th century, all of this collapsed with the collapse of the glory of Muslim civilization in that part of the world. Even in Christianity, Jews in feudal Europe in the early years were welcome. They were brought specially there to help found cities. Charters were given to them, protecting their rights. And for several centuries, they certainly were in a much more privileged position than the serfs, and they even had the right to ride horses. They even had a right to bear arms in those early days. It was only with the breakdown and the collapse of the larger society, the insecurities inherent in the nature of nations who see their security lying in power, that they began to be pogromed. But when Jews were pogromed in Northern Europe, they went to Spain, where they were welcomed. The same crusaders that were denouncing them for killing Christ in the north found that they were absolutely vital and necessary when they moved, when these same princes moved, taking over the Islamic lands in the south. Perhaps some of you saw just the other day that Poland is offering to provide Jews going to Israel with passage through Poland, when Hungary, for whatever the reason, is no longer allowing it. And they referred to the fact that Poland had been this great haven of Jewish refuge back in the 15th century. That's right. Jews were fleeing collapsing Germany, the insecurity of Germany, and moving to the security of Poland, which at that time was a very thriving state by comparison, showered with the same kind of charters that were being taken away from them. So here you have three parts of Christianity. You have northern Christian Europe pogroming the Jews. The Christian Europe that's building up in Spain, welcoming these very same Jews. The Jews are suffering from the insecurities of the collapse of the German Empire in Central Europe. And they go to Poland, where Poland is only too happy to have them. And then what happens in Poland just a few centuries subsequently? And what about the modern period? After all, who compelled the Dutch to allow the Jews to settle? What power did the Jews exercise that they could settle in Holland? And in terms of international trade, to be treated as equals? And when you got your really first true modern Western society. Or perhaps it was the great power of the Jews possessed in the colonies.